Israel is vowing to retaliate against Iran.
We will respond the way that we will choose at the time that we will choose.
The U.S. Supreme Court questions whether federal prosecutors went too far in bringing obstruction charges against participants in the 2021 U.S. Capitol riot.
Would a sit-in that disrupts a trial or access to a federal courthouse qualify?
And the flame that will burn at the Paris Olympics has been kindled at the site of the ancient games. Today is Wednesday, April 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Alexis Strope. Israel is vowing to retaliate against Iran, even though such a mission carries many risks. Israeli military spokesman Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari says Israel will respond when and how it chooses.
We don't just have defensive capabilities. We were proven on Saturday night. We have offensive capabilities, and we will know what to do and when to do and how to do.
Any direct attack on Iranian soil would risk prompting an all-out war between the two foes at a time when Israel is focused on defeating Hamas in Gaza. It would also risk isolating Israel internationally. VOA correspondent Michael Lippin talks with Avi Melamed, a distinguished geopolitical Middle East expert, intelligence analyst, and author. He is founder and CEO of Inside the Middle East Intelligence Perspectives.
Well, look, I think it's important to understand what are the guiding lines of possible Israeli action. And there are a couple of things that I think are very relevant in that regard. First, it has to be coordinated with the United States. It has to be something that will, on the one hand, be powerful enough to send a very, very strong message across the Middle East, basically making clear that attacking Israel is something that has a very significant price tag. But at the same time, it has to be something not too much painful to the point it will cause the Mullah regime to react and actually generate a process of potential further escalation. So it has something that has to include all those components and others, obviously taking into consideration other things, operational, intelligence-wise, and so on. But I think that in the end of the day, these are the, I would say, guiding concepts that will shape the possible Israeli reaction. So when I look at all those components, I tend to incline that it will be very likely that there will be a series of covert but significant Israeli attacks against Iranian assets.
When you look at Iran's warnings about what it would do if Israel strikes back, there have been a lot of verbal threats that we're going to respond quickly, harder than before, in a way that Israel's not expecting. What can you infer from these verbal warnings and from Iran's other actions about how Iran might respond to an Israeli attack?
Well, similar to Israel, I would say that Iran is also subject to a set of calculations. I would say that at this point, the Iranian threats are not negating those threats, because we know that the Iranian has the capacity and they have the willingness to do that, and we just had an example of that. Without negating the seriousness of those rhetoric, I would say that at this point, it seems to me like those statements are more aimed to trying to deter or to prevent what seems to be like almost an imminent Israeli reaction, or at least try to hint to Israel what could be the nature of an Israeli reaction that Iran could live with, sort of speaking, and not necessarily feel that it has to react. But of course, we know that Iran also has the network of proxies across the region, that Iran could continue and further intensify the use of those proxies as they have been doing so far in a situation of a potential Israeli attack against Iranian assets. So I would take the Iranian rhetoric seriously. I would look at it at this point as something that mostly aims to try to deter Israel from potential attack, and maybe some sort of an Iranian signal to Israel that Iran could live, sort of speaking, with some sort of an Israeli action, but not something that will put the Iranian regime in a position where it will feel that it has obliged, actually, to react to a possible Israeli reaction.
VOA correspondent Michael Lippin speaking with Avi Melamed. The U.S. Supreme Court is at the center of a question surrounding the U.S. Capitol riot in 2021. Here is Mark Sherman, Supreme Court writer for the Associated Press.
The justices had tough questions for the Justice Department about whether the law, which was adopted in the wake of the Enron financial scandal more than two decades ago, can be used against January 6th defendants. The government has so far charged about 330 people with obstructing an official proceeding for their role in the January 6th riot.
The answer to that question could have major implications for former President Donald Trump as he faces the same charge for his alleged efforts to overturn his election loss in 2020. The case before the court involves Joseph Fisher, a former Pennsylvania police officer who has been indicted for his role at the riot. Several justices seemed skeptical of prosecutors' use of the law to bring charges, such as Justice Neil Gorsuch, who posed hypothetical questions during the proceeding.
Would a sit-in that disrupts a trial or access to a federal courthouse qualify? Would a heckler in today's audience qualify or at the State of the Union address? Would pulling a fire alarm before a vote qualify for 20 years in federal prison?
Mark Sherman says it's unclear how the court will ultimately decide.
There were some justices on the conservative side of the court who seemed to favor a broad ruling that might prohibit the government from using the charge at all against January 6th defendants. Another possibility is that the court could take a more measured approach and require lower courts to evaluate on a case-by-case basis.
A decision from the court is expected by late June. We're also following these stories from around the world. Indian security forces say they killed at least 29 Maoist rebels in a gun battle in the central state of Chhattisgarh on Tuesday. Maoists have waged a guerrilla-style struggle against the government and say they are fighting to give poor Indian farmers and landless laborers more control over their land and a greater claim to its minerals currently exploited by major mining companies. A fire raged through one of Copenhagen's oldest buildings Tuesday, destroying about half of the 17th-century-old stock exchange and collapsing its iconic dragon-tail spire as passersby rushed to help emergency services save priceless paintings and other valuables. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's plan to ban anyone age 15 and younger from buying cigarettes passed its first parliamentary vote on Tuesday, although dozens of his own lawmakers voted against it. Sunak's plan to impose some of the world's strictest anti-smoking rules has angered some members of his governing Conservative Party, including former Prime Ministers Liz Truss and Boris Johnson, who say the state should not interfere in how people live their lives. U.S. presidential candidates Joe Biden and Donald Trump are both supporting Israel in the war in Gaza and in its hostilities with Iran. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns reports on how events in the Middle East are shaping U.S. politics.
Iran's attack on Israel and America's role in the Middle East as issues in this U.S. presidential campaign are a contest over which candidate backs Israel most. As incumbent, President Joe Biden oversaw the U.S. response to the attack and reaffirmed U.S. support for Israel in a meeting with the Iraqi prime minister.
The United States is committed to Israel's security. We're committed to a ceasefire that will bring the hostages home and preventing conflict from spreading beyond what it already has. We're also committed to the security of our personnel and partners in the region, including Iraq.
Politically, Biden is facing competing calls to do more to help secure the release of hostages held by Hamas and to get tougher with Israel over its attacks in Gaza. His opponent, Donald Trump, says none of the violence in the Middle East would have happened if he were still president, without explaining how.
I want to say God bless the people of Israel. They're under attack right now. That's because we show great weakness. This would not happen. The weakness that we've shown is unbelievable, and it would not have happened if we were in office. You know that. They know that. Everybody knows that.
The Trump campaign is working to portray Biden as weak on Israel on Trump's social media platform and through Republican lawmakers, including House Speaker Mike Johnson.
Joe Biden has transformed into an anti-Israel president. There's really no other way to characterize it. He's more concerned seemingly with placating the anti-Semitism in his base than standing with our historic and vitally important ally.
In the Midwestern state of Michigan, voter Carol Plissner says Biden needs to keep up his support for Israel.
I think initially President Biden's response to the situation was helpful and it was supportive. I think as time has gone on, that's become more questionable. And I think that the United States needs to have a stance that's deeply protective of democracy across the world. And that means deeply respectful of Israel.
Biden's support for Israel in Gaza is reason to oppose him, says Michigan voter Mohammed Mawri.
He's complicit in in a catastrophe that's happening 1,000 miles away. People think that it's not hurting us, but it is. We're aiding it with our money.
Polling by Pew Research last month showed deep divides on the issue, with about 20% of U.S. voters saying Biden striking the right balance, another 20% saying he's favoring Israel, and 16% saying he's favoring Palestinians. The largest group in that poll was not sure how well Biden's handling the issue. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
Facing a Republican revolt, U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson pushes ahead on aid for Ukraine and other U.S. allies. AP correspondent Sagar Meghani reports.
House Speaker Mike Johnson is pushing ahead on U.S. aid for Ukraine and other allies amid growing GOP anger. Johnson's thin Republican majority is again sending the aid, which would force him to rely on Democrats to help pass it. Kentucky's Thomas Massey says he's had enough.
We need a speaker who is not doing everything Chuck Schumer wants.
Republicans in the room during a private meeting this morning say Massey suggested Johnson should resign or risk a vote to oust him.
I am not resigning, and it is, in my view, an absurd notion.
Johnson says he knew it would be a tough job.
I regard myself as a wartime speaker.
And says he will move forward with votes to send aid to Ukraine, Israel, and other allies, though his multi-part plan leaves out a key GOP priority, southern border security. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
Donald Trump's lawyers and prosecutors on Tuesday began challenging prospective jurors who may serve in his hush money criminal trial. The judge rebuked the former U.S. president for speaking while one potential juror was being questioned. Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen has more.
Trump, who is once again seeking the White House, is the first ex-president to ever stand trial on criminal charges. He was rebuked on Tuesday by New York Justice Juan Merchan for speaking while one potential juror was being questioned. The judge told Trump's lawyer, quote, "I will not have any jurors intimidated in this courtroom." Trump faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to cover up a payment to porn star Stormy Daniels shortly before the 2016 election. Daniels says she had a sexual encounter with Trump about a decade beforehand. Trump has pleaded not guilty and denies the alleged affair. Jury selection began Monday. Lawyers need to pick 12 members of the jury and 6 alternates.
Hilariously, yesterday while walking in, my first thought when I saw him was, oh, he looks exactly like he does on TV.
Kara McGee didn't make the cut. She said the commitment to a trial that could run for weeks or longer was too much for her schedule, though she felt she and her fellow potential jurors were taking the process seriously.
I think regardless of what people came into it thinking about the defendant, there were other people as well in the jury box who answered the questions honestly and said, like, yes, I have family members who have been involved with X political thing. I have X opinion about something on this jury sheet, but I believe that I can put that aside and be unbiased.
Trump, a Republican, has called the case a partisan witch hunt brought by Democratic Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, meant to interfere with his campaign to unseat President Joe Biden, a Democrat, in the November 5th election.
I should be right now in Pennsylvania, in Florida, in many other states, North Carolina, Georgia, campaigning. This is all coming from the Biden White House because the guy can't put two sentences together. He can't campaign. They're using this in order to try and win an election, and it's not working that way. It's working the opposite way.
Jury selection is expected to consume the rest of the week, and the trial is scheduled to last at least through May.
Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Alexis Strope. The Venezuelan Information Ministry said in a statement on Tuesday that Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has ordered the closure of his government's embassy and 2 consulates in Ecuador in protest of Ecuador's detention of former Vice President Jorge Glass. VOA correspondent Scott Walterman has more.
The battle of the embassies has been escalated as Venezuela has sided with Mexico. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro.
El presidente Daniel Noboa debió haber dado la cara hoy.
He's saying President Daniel Noboa should have had to appear today in front of the whole Latin America and the Caribbean and take responsibility in front of Ecuador, in front of Latin America, in front of the Caribbean, and in front of the world. But he hasn't faced the consequences. He went on to say that Venezuela President Daniel Noboa has hidden, and the people of Ecuador must know why President Daniel Noboa hasn't faced the consequences, and he's not taking responsibility for his actions, unquote. Now, all of this started when Quito security forces stormed the Mexican embassy on April 5th to arrest former Ecuadorian Vice President Jorge Glass, who was wanted on corruption charges and had been granted asylum at the embassy by Mexico. Maduro demanded that Glass be freed from the maximum security prison where he's now being held and handed over to Mexico. Mexico has filed a lawsuit against Ecuador at the International Court of Justice in The Hague, saying it wants the country suspended from the United Nations. Embassies are considered to be the sovereign territory of the country that operates the embassy. So when the police went into the Mexican embassy, it was like walking into Mexico and making an arrest. Maduro's comments played out at a meeting of the community of Latin American and Caribbean states. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador urged the member states to support his country by co-signing its complaint at the UN court. Scott Walterman, VOA News.
1 year since a conflict erupted between the Sudanese military and the notorious paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, millions are on the verge of famine as the UN chief warns of the threat the conflict is expanding, as VOA's Lori London reports.
Aid workers describe a neglected but devastating conflict in Sudan that has destroyed homes and infrastructure, created the world's biggest displacement crisis, and killed thousands of civilians.
Over 8 million people have fled their homes in search of safety, 1.8 million to neighboring countries. The latest reports of escalating hostilities in El Fasher, the capital of North Darfur, are a fresh cause for deep alarm.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Monday that indiscriminate attacks could amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Aid convoys have been targeted. Humanitarian personnel and warehouses have been attacked. Women and girls are subject to rampant sexual violence. And meanwhile, the impact of the conflict is spilling across borders.
And according to Guterres, the main problem is clear.
There are two generals that have opted for a military solution. And they have until now obstructed all serious efforts of mediation. All these efforts failed for a very simple reason, because the two parties have made a bet, and the bet is to win militarily. And for that, mediation is irrelevant.
Efforts to help millions of people driven to the verge of famine by the war have been held up by continued fighting, restrictions imposed by the warring sides, and demands on donors from other global crises, including in Gaza and Ukraine. The UN has said nearly 25 million people, half of Sudan's population, need aid. International donors met in Paris on Monday to pledge humanitarian support for Sudan. At the aid conference, French President Emmanuel Macron said 2 billion euros had been raised for Sudan. Lori London, VOA News, Washington.
10 years ago, hundreds of schoolgirls were abducted in northern Nigeria by the Islamist terror group Boko Haram. In the decades since the raid, mass abductions have become frequent, and activists have grown weary. VOA's Timothy Abizu reports from Abuja.
President Bola Tinubu's opinion piece for Newsweek magazine titled 10 Years Since Chibok, Nigeria Will No Longer Pay the Price, was published Monday. In it, Tinubu said ransom payments to gangs only encouraged gangs to commit more crimes and said, quote, the extortion racket must be squeezed out of existence, end quote. The president said, instead of ransom, perpetrators of the violence will receive the security services counteractions. Tinubu said the government's response to the Chibok abduction in 2014 was slow, But the president said Nigeria must recognize the changing nature of the threat. He said criminal gangs behind more recent kidnappings are primarily after cash rewards, unlike Boko Haram, which sought to impose Islamist rule. In 2022, Tinubu's predecessor, Muhammadu Buhari, tried to criminalize ransom payments to kidnappers, but the decision was met with resistance from activists and families of victims. The Nigerian president ended his article by saying, quote, "There will be no more ransoms paid to kidnappers nor towards policies which have trapped our people economically," end quote. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
The flame that will burn at the Paris Olympics has been kindled at the site of the ancient games in southern Greece, though cloudy skies hampered the effort. An actress dressed as an ancient Greek priestess attempted to use the sun to ignite a silver torch in the traditional fashion. Instead, a backup flame was used. It had been lit on the same spot during the final rehearsal, AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
The flame for this summer's Paris Olympics was lit on Tuesday at the birthplace of the ancient Olympic Games in southern Greece in a meticulously choreographed ceremony. From the ancient stadium in Olympia, a relay of torchbearers will carry the flame over 3,000 miles until the handover to the Paris Game organisers in Athens on April 26. International Olympic Committee President Thomas Bach praises the successful flame lighting ceremony and says the games are good for the world.
The Olympic Games, you know, they're the only event which really bring the entire world together at one place.
Spyros Kapralos, Hellenic Olympic Committee President, echoes the message.
Our aim is to remind everybody what in ancient Greece they were doing during the Olympic Games. They would stop the wars, they would put down the arms.
I'm Charles de Ledesma.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Alexis Strope.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
When Iran launched its aerial attack on Israel on April 13th, it was, as Secretary of State Antony Blinken said, unprecedented in its scope and in its scale.
In its scope because it represented the first direct attack by Iran on Israel. In its scale because, as I said, there were more than 300 munitions fired, including ballistic missiles, as well as land attack cruise missiles and drones. Thanks to Israeli air defenses, as well as support from other countries, including U.S. military assets, virtually all of the incoming projectiles were destroyed and shot down.
What the weekend demonstrated, said Secretary Blinken, is that Israel did not have to and does not have to defend itself alone when it is the victim of an aggression. National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby also underscored that the response showed that unlike Iran, which is increasingly isolated on the world stage, Israel has friends.
Israel has great skill, great professionalism, great military capability, and that's not by accident. All of that comes from the support that they get, particularly from the United States, but other countries as well.
Advisor Kirby noted that the attack on Israel was a spectacular and embarrassing failure for Iran.
Given the scale of this attack, Iran's intent was clearly to cause significant destruction and casualties. It didn't work. This attack was defeated thanks to our preparations, to a coalition of committed partners, and to Israel's remarkable defensive systems. Israel today is in a far stronger strategic position than it was only a few days ago. Iran's vaunted missile program, something it has used to threaten Israel in the region, proved to be far less effective.
Advisor Kirby noted that much of the world today is standing with Israel, and he pointed to the condemnation of Iran's direct and unprecedented attack against Israel from the leaders of the G7 countries. U.S. teams, he said, are now following up with G7 capitals on new multilateral sanctions to target Iran's missile and other nefarious programs. So that's the upshot here, declared Advisor Kirby. A stronger Israel, a weaker Iran, a more unified alliance of partners. That was not Iran's intent when it launched this attack on Saturday night, not even close. And again, they failed. They failed utterly.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.